Hi, welcome to the brand new Clinical Scientist podcast. I'm Emma Rees, a co-founder of The Clinical Scientist. I'm an academic clinical scientist at Swansea University and I specialise in echo. The aim of this podcast is to bring leading clinical scientists closer to you, wherever you're listening. We'll explore topics such as advanced practice, scientific leadership and clinical research. We'd like to start with a short series of interviews which discuss one of the routes to the consultant grade. That's the HSST, or Higher Specialist Scientific Training Programme. In these interviews, we'll chat to HSST trainees in a variety of disciplines. We'll explore their motivation for applying to their programme. We'll talk about the best and the most challenging elements. And we'll also ask them what advice they'd give to a prospective applicant. In this episode, you'll hear from James Willis, who's a clinical scientist in cardiology, specialising in echo at the Royal United Hospitals in Bath, and from Alison Hadfield, a clinical scientist in haematology at Newcastle.
So my name's James Willis. I work at the Royal United Hospital in Bath, and I'm a first year HSST trainee on the cardiac sciences pathway, specialising in echo, heading into year two as of September this year.
Fantastic. Alison?
Hi, my name's Alison Hadfield. My specialism is haematology, and I work in Newcastle upon Tyne. And I'm, like James, I'm at the end of my first year, about to start my second year.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So let's kick off by chatting about what motivated you to start HSST, because, you know, it's quite a big undertaking. It's a long time to study for, and it'd be interesting to hear why you decided you wanted to start this. Can I come to you first, Alison?
So I started to do it because my job role is very scientific. We don't really have that much to do with the clinicians or the patients, not patient facing. And I wanted to bridge the gap between us and the clinicians. So quite often we get to a certain point and we refer it to a haematology registrar or consultant. And I wanted to bridge that gap between the lab and the clinicians. And this was a good opportunity to learn all those bits.
Fantastic. James?
I think it was recognising that in this position in my career, there was an opportunity to undergo some really good sort of leadership and management training, which is some of the feedback I'd heard from other people on the course. They were really selling that as being quite high calibre and really sort of structured in the way that it was delivered. So there was an opportunity there to get a bit of experience. But also, like Alison said, really, it's an opportunity to provide that bridging between registrar, consultant, etc., to offer a novel way of doing things or a different way of doing things that maybe isn't being fulfilled anymore with some of the medical training that maybe is going on. So there was definitely a gap within my department to sort of see where we were able to upskill and help with things like complex echo services and things like that. And so this was an opportunity to get some structured training, importantly recognised by the trust, so you've got buy-in at all levels as well, so it gives you that bit of security for 5 years, and sort of tangible goals to go through across the five-year period, really, in a structured format.
So it sounds like having the structure of learning that bridges across to more clinical medicine a little bit, if you like, was important for both of you. And I guess that contrasts with maybe for some of our professions in the past, we haven't had this route, have we? We haven't had this pathway available. You know, we've been able to become managers of services, or perhaps people have left and gone to industry, or they've gone to an academic environment. And perhaps we haven't managed to keep hold of some of the people who really were at the top of their game, but wanted to stay with a scientific focus. So I think this is a fantastic opportunity for our profession. I think it's an amazing, amazing pathway that's been developed. What do you hope it will lead to at the end for each of you? So you might have seen some of the questions on Twitter have been related to, you know, are people expecting an automatic consultant post at the end? Or is it more that it will make you eligible to apply for a consultant post. Do you hope that you can convince your health board that a consultant is needed in your service? And here you are, ready to go. James, let's start with you.
I think that's a really good point. It would probably be wrong of me to say that I know where the post is going to be in 5 years' time or 4 years' time. And I sort of entered this fully expecting that there was going to be conversations along the way about what happens when you finish the programme and where to go from there. I think you're absolutely right, though. Part of what I hope to achieve, you know, with the team that I'm working with is to demonstrate the areas we're capable of working in and how we can collaborate across different professions. And more importantly, provide a service that can work alongside the consultants that we have in place already, and show that it's capable for the scientist team to upskill and produce work at that sort of level. But that conversation about what happens in 5 years' time is ongoing and will be for the next couple of years, I would imagine.
Yeah, and is that the same for you, Alison?
I would say so. At the moment, the post obviously doesn't exist. I've got a couple of colleagues who are a year and 2 years ahead of me, I'm currently a band 7 and they've both been promoted into 8A positions. So I would hope that I would get promoted into an 8A position in the next 4 years and then see what happens at the end of that.
Yeah, and I think for some of the disciplines, the consultant role has been available for longer. For example, in the physics sciences, I know that it's been available for longer. A couple of the other interviewees I spoke to said that they had that promotion route during the course. So they'd gone to 8A and somebody said 8B during the training. So it sounds like that's something that's happening more and more. I don't know if that's a standard expectation of the programme or if that's individual to hospitals. Do you have a sense of that? Alison, do you know?
I don't think so. I know at the start we all had to be band 7, so all three of us were band 7 to start off with, and I think for my two colleagues the position has just been vacated, someone's retired or whatever, so then they've got promoted into it, and I do think as an 8A they have a more freedom than I do as a band 7, so I always have to go to my managers to get approval for things, whereas they have a little bit more freedom. So I'm hoping at some point in the next 4 years that I'm able to achieve that AA, which will give me a bit more freedom and allow me to fill some of the competencies for one file, which in my current position, I'm not struggling with, but I think it would be easier if I was an AA.
Yeah. And James, what about what's happening in cardiology? Are people getting promoted during the course, do you know, or it's not something that's been discussed very much?
Currently not something that I'm aware has been discussed at sort of a great level. We're obviously still finding our feet with a lot of this. And I think we obviously know that there are consultants that exist already outside of this via equivalents or just, you know, sort of via grandparenting to a certain extent. That still needs to be established and see the initial cohort actually come out of this at the very end. And hopefully they'll provide a template from which we can move forward. But I think it would be remiss of me to say that we haven't had discussions now about what I'm sort of expecting over the next 3 to 5 years in terms of potential promotions as we go.
If I can take you back to when you started or when you were applying, can you tell me a little bit about what you thought of the application process and the interview? Give our listeners a sense of, if they apply, what should they expect from that process? Because, you know, it's helpful to be able to prepare for that sort of thing, isn't it, James?
For me, it all started with the expression of interest, really, when that was initially announced. It was then a question of sitting down and actually looking at the information that was available on the school's website. And I sat there with my manager, who's been, you know, incredibly sort of supportive of the process from start to finish. And we had a very frank conversation, said, where do we think I am at in my career at the moment? Where do I need to go? What can we provide in the service? And we looked at the learning objectives and the big document that they produce and sort of said, well, we think I'm here and I think I'm probably here, etc. So we actually left it for a year, 2 years before applying. And then when I realised that you know, the opportunities were there to branch off into things like leadership and management, we approached it again. And then, as I said, it was the expression of interest that went in to make sure that the registering the interest in funding. Then it was the statement that you put together to begin with as part of the application form. And obviously all of that involves a bit of work. It involves understanding the course and sort of writing your application to guide where you want it to go, and then also understanding where you want the process to end. So going through all of that, you then get to the interview stage. And that was pretty nerve-wracking, to be honest. Most of the people applying to this course probably fairly experienced in their field at this stage anyway, but suddenly having to go up there and really sort of justify it and engage the level that they're interested in was quite an experience, but obviously a positive one at the end of the day.
Okay. And Alison, what did you think of the interview itself? How was it structured?
So I was quite unique in that I had to go through STP equivalents to get onto to become a clinical scientist. So I'm dual registered as a biomedical scientist and a clinical scientist. So I actually found the STP equivalents the most difficult part of it. And that took me almost a year to get that. I had an interview. I didn't manage to pass one of the requirements. So then I actually wanted to start the previous year, but I couldn't manage to get equivalents in time. So I'd already gone through HSST interviews once already, expecting to get equivalence in time, and then I had to go through it again. So actually, having gone through the interviews twice, the second time I wasn't worried at all. But I agree with James, there are a lot of people who obviously know their stuff. And when it came to the scientific part, they just pick one little part of that discipline. And if that's not your area of interest, then you're stuck. I mean, thankfully, I consider myself to be more of a jack of all trades, master of none. So I've got quite broad knowledge. So I was able to answer everything, maybe not in as much detail as they want, but having gone through it twice, they do ask the same sort of questions over and over again.
We've had people say that those who'd gone through the STP interviews, because they were panel interviews and stations, that prepared them quite well for HSST interviews, which were like that, you know, having somebody described it as a long version of speed dating, where you were with different people in different stations for a very short amount of time, and you had to try and convince them in that short amount of time that, you know, you were right for it. Did you know... Did you go in having to give a presentation as well about what research you wanted to do? Because I'm guessing that had to took a little bit of thinking as well before applying. So I think that's an important point for people to realise, is that they have to have an idea of what research they're going to do at the end when they start. Because it's quite a way off. How long was the presentation? Did you give a presentation?
Yeah, it was about 10 minutes, and it was... it was about some research or innovation you'd already done. So we'd installed a load of new equipment. So I talked about that and how we'd validated it and how we'd spawned some mini projects away from that, and talked about the research based on that.
Ah, right. So you didn't have to talk about what research you were hoping to do.
No, I still don't know what I want to do. So.
Yeah, I wonder if the interviews changed, because the people we spoke to who were further in the course had to give a presentation on what research they wanted to do at the end of the course. James, was your experience the same as Alison's then, because you're in the same cohort?
Yeah, they definitely didn't ask about what we were aiming to do or about an innovation that we had. We had put together. I think they recognise probably the need to get on top of the final bit of research quite early, because certainly at the induction talk that we went to, literally on the very first day, they were already sort of saying, you need to be thinking about this coming in to, you know, the start of year two, and certainly going in into sort of September, I'm sure there'll be more talk now about formulating an idea, etc. But From the presentation point of view, it was prepped and ready. You submit it a couple of weeks in advance, so once you put it together and send it off, that's it. It's gone. You've got to, you know, deliver the same thing to the examiners. But it was very much about something that you'd already done, and there may be one or two questions about aspirations, but it's mainly focusing on something that you've implemented.
Okay, thinking about the structure of the course a little bit more, can you give the listeners an overview on the main components of the course, James?
So the bulk of what we've done so far is what's known as the A modules, which is the leadership and management, and that's at the Manchester Business School. They've been fantastic. That's been up until around about March, when something happened. the sort of the leadership and management bit, and that's been our face-to-face teaching. So that's been fantastic. You know, sort of quite a high level of intrepidation going into it, really not knowing what to expect, but it's been delivered very well. We've worked in sort of big groups and everything, and that's been fantastic. It's been really enlightening. We then have the B modules, which focus more on the clinical skills. And that involved, from a cardiac perspective, spending a week up in with Insure, working with people up there. And then very much it's about getting out and doing the clinical work. So I'm spending a lot of time at the moment heading out on ward rounds with the medical team first thing in the morning. And part of what I'm trying to do is identify areas where we can add benefit to what they're doing on their ward round that maybe they haven't considered before, or maybe something unique that a scientist can bring. And that's then tied up in clinical skills examinations. So part of the coursework we have to deliver then is be examining patients, and obviously, you know, history taking, physical exam, etc. That's something that we may have touched upon in the past, but now needs to be built upon. So that's kind of where we're at the moment, really, is heading into year two. Will there be more leadership modules and building on the clinical skills as well?
Okay. Alison?
Yeah, pretty much the same as James, apart from the B modules, really. So A modules, I decided, elected to do the first two in year one. And then it all went online from March onwards, which actually I think worked quite well for me, even though I enjoyed meeting people and interaction with people. Each to their own. And then I'm going to try and do some more A modules next year. But the B side of things, I just have to sit the FRC path exams. So the plan is to try and sit the first part one at the beginning of the third year. So for haematology, they only run once a year. I think for some of the disciplines, they run twice a year. For haematology, it's only once a year, and that's the autumn or September session. So it's kind of, for me, it's been described as a textbook exam by my supervisor. So it's very much rotating around some of the specialist parts of the lab, learning more about that, and then trying to get out to the clinics and watch a registrar and consultant in action and try and build that gap, because the lab knowledge is one thing, but actually applying that to patients is something different. So
I guess the differences there are then, so the A module is the same for all of the sciences by the seam of it, the B module is different, and then the C module, I guess, is that the research, innovation, etc., etc., and that's the same potentially then for all groups. Do you know if people who have a PhD, because somebody else has asked this question, get exemption from the research element if it's a clinical PhD, you know, a specialist?
I believe so, but I think it has to be assessed by the National School first.
So case by case basis, probably.
Yeah, I think
then.
And
do you know people in your disciplines who've done a PhD or who are on the course and have done a PhD and are doing this as well? Somebody asked about on Twitter about the added value. James?
Yeah, I'm doing it. That's what I'm doing at the moment. So part of what attracted me to the actual course was the opportunity to get effectively funded research time towards the end of the course. So exactly as Alison said, it's possible to opt out and you can apply. There's still a route that you have to go through where you have to produce a piece of work, but not to the same extent as you would do with the final prof doc bit. I'm opting to do that as well towards the end of the course, just to kind of give me that structure again and the opportunity to carry on doing some sort of particular research areas, which is you know, really sort of strong focus for the course for me.
Yeah, so clear added value for you then, even though you've already got a PhD. Brilliant. That will answer that person's question really well. Can you give a sense of, I mean, workload is hard to chat about because I imagine it's very variable across the course. I imagine it comes in condensed periods and then there's lighter periods. But maybe if you could give a sense of how many days you've spent in uni in a term or in a year, and then how you're finding the workload, how you're managing the workload.
Obviously I've spent 5 days, 6 days in Manchester, and then we were due to spend another three for A2, but obviously thanks to COVID they were all cancelled, and we get a study day a week. So I successfully managed to get my study days for the first part of the course from September up to January, and then I've not managed to any since then, which I think is par for the course, really. I mean, they say one day a week, but I think it very much depends on your employer and what's going on at the same time. And I would say it's manageable. I mean, well, I'm only 1 year in, so I might feel differently in a couple of years' time. I'm fortunate, maybe. I'm engaged, but I don't have a family, so there's just me and Chris to worry about. I don't have anyone else to worry about. And I would say, for me, it's probably taking, if I included my 1 day a week and then probably a half day at the weekend. Thanks to lockdown, I'm not getting any study time. So I'm probably spending a lot more of my time than I would have done. But that's just the way it goes.
Yeah. And James, is your experience the same?
Yeah, I think this course has definitely taught me about time management, really, which is massively important. One of the things that I sort of did before signing up to this really was have a very frank and honest conversation with my wife and say, well, where, you know, are we going to go through this again for 5 years? Are you relatively happy with this decision? Because the family life, I have two young daughters, and Chloe was born, or you know, in July, and I started the course in September. So I sort of left my wife with a two-month-old baby to go and start going up to Manchester for periods of time, which was very tough. But I'm very fortunate in that my departments support me very well. I get my 1 day a week to work on things. I think exactly like Alison said, there's at least half, if not another day, that's spread out over evenings and weekends. Maybe not necessarily in sort of big concentrations of time, but I'd say I barely go sort of 48 hours without working on an element of this for a couple of hours over various different periods. But that, at the moment, it's to be expected. And what I tend to do is look at what workload's coming up in terms of essays that need to be handed in and try and factor that in with a couple of extra days, maybe take some leave, or again, being very well supported, the department's given me an extra day to go in to carry on and get these bits done. So I know when there's pinch points coming up and just try and front load that as much as possible.
Yeah. And it sounds like the having a really supportive department is vital for you in grasping all the opportunities that are associated with the programme. I can imagine that you could get by without really, really strong support. But I imagine that really curtails your ability to take opportunities to go and see different things in the workplace, or to go and watch other clinics or that sort of thing. Do you have to have a specific mentor or role model, coach, whatever it is, while you're on the programme, James?
Yes, you do. So you have to have several identified people to the national school. So I may have misinterpreted this, but it's slightly confusing in the sense that you have a training officer, much like you would do for supporting someone with the STP, but the training officer doesn't actually have anything to do with the delivery of your material. They're there to support the logistics of the course. So my line manager, the head of department, is my training officer. But then you have your sort of academic supervisor, which is one of the cardiologists, Dr. Augustine. And then you have a research supervisor. And then you also have a series of mentors as well. So I'm fortunate to have a couple of mentors that support me in various different ways. And essentially they become a sounding board for ideas, but also to present opportunities, you know, should they arise. You have to have quite a strong team in place. And for those people who've looked after STP candidates, you'll know how important that team is to sort of help with all aspects of the course, really. Support, guidance, advice, all of that is really key.
Is that the same for you, Alison?
I think James is very lucky. That's what. I have a clinical supervisor who is a consultant haematologist, and then I have my managers in the lab. I think I'm maybe at a bit of a disadvantage because they don't really seem to understand what I'm doing. And they keep asking for my curriculum, which I have told them multiple times what it is, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement. Now, that could be COVID related more than anything else at the moment. I think that's, you know, put a bit of a spanner in the works because I've not been able to go out and rotate as much as I would like to. But I must admit my clinical supervisor has been very good, and he's a consultant, so that's been helpful.
A couple of people have talked about the need in some departments for a bit of a culture change, professional culture change, you know, that the realisation that to offer you these opportunities might impact on the clinical side of your work in the short term, but in the long term, the benefits that will be reaped from you working at that higher scientific level will be really significant. And I think in departments where they've been sending students on HSST for longer, or they've had a consultant path for longer, the culture is a little bit different. And I do think that, you know, knowledge or lack of knowledge amongst the team that you're working in, it sounds like it has a big impact on your progress. But obviously that will change with time, and you're, Alison, you're chipping away in your department. So the people who come after you will obviously find it easier because they'll, yeah, you know, they'll have the benefit of your experience. Okay, fantastic. So what's been the hardest part, the most challenging, the bit that you thought, oh my gosh, I'm not sure I can do this? Alison?
I think at the start it was writing the social science essays. I think we're very analytical, proper, sciencey people, and then you've got to write this. You're allowed an opinion and you can write in the first person. I found that quite tricky to start off with. I mean, now I've done A1, I've done A2, I'm 4 essays down and I feel okay about it now. But that's for me that been the most tricky part so far. I think I've got a lot of challenges to come. I think, like you say about culture change, I've got to try and change the culture of the department a bit more. Confess, I've not even thought about the research project yet. I want to concentrate on getting some experience and getting my B modules up and sitting FRC path first. But I must admit, for the newbies, I think the social science essay was tricky to start off with.
A couple of other people have expressed that, but looking back on it, do you feel like you benefited from doing them, from approaching something from a very different perspective than we would usually take?
Definitely. I mean, it would be a struggle now to write a proper scientific essay, I must admit.
I'm sure it won't be. But James, what's been the hardest bit for you?
Completely agree with Alison. I remember sitting in the hotel room at sort of 2 a.m. in the morning looking at this essay for, you know, however many hours, just kind of going, I literally have no benchmark for how to write this sort of thing. So is it going to be good enough? Is it going to be okay? And yeah, exactly the same situation, 4 essays in now and I'm feeling a lot more comfortable with it. And I really do think it has been useful. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we've done, I've really taken back to the department and started to look at it and question, and I feel it's been massively beneficial in that sense. But the most tricky bit really is the time management. It's quite a concern sort of on occasions to look at how much you've actually got to achieve. And the thing that you get told a lot when you go and sign up to this course, it's bespoke, and they use that word a lot. And I think, you know, we're all scientists. We like things to be nice and, you know, binary and explained in that sense. So to be told you've got free rein to kind of do something is very liberating, but at the same time can be almost crippling in a way that you're going, okay, well, how do I achieve this? How do I get to this point where I feel like I've hit this level, I've achieved X, Y, and Z. And obviously with everything that goes on in academia, there's an element of imposter syndrome as well. So, you know, being able to sort of go, okay, I've passed the interview, I've got on this course, I've got this student bubble for the next few years, but we really do need to think about what happens at the end of it and how do I get my colleagues and other professions to sort of buy in and go, we can deliver stuff at this level. So I think there's intrepidation about the unknown going forward, but that's just a problem for the entire program that we're all going to sort of develop together really and understand how that's going to progress over time.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, at consultant level, there's an expectation that you plan your own job. You know, you have control over the elements of your own role. So in essence, having a bespoke program where you have to control elements of the training is preparing you for that, isn't it? And it seems as though when I speak to people at different stages in this, those who are further along, although I've no doubt there's still an element of that imposter syndrome, they do seem more confident that, okay, you know, this has prepared me well. I do feel like I'm getting to the point where I'm ready. And they've also talked about, you know, the length of time that it takes to do this and the working across different disciplines that's necessary to complete the program is helping to build trust with other professions, so that by the time you complete, those other professions do trust your judgment and they trust the training and the education that you've had, because it's not just, you know, a snip and, you know, it's a flash in the pan, you've done something short and then you're let loose. It is a long training period. So let's go from the challenging to the really exciting bits, the bits that you thought, oh, this is amazing. which bits have stood out for you as the real highlights? James, I'll come to you first.
I think it's the opportunity to really engage with how the medics are training and look at some of the things that they're doing. Like I said, you know, attending the ward rounds, getting involved with the assessment of the patient, and having the freedom to be able to do that sort of stuff is very liberating. But as you've already identified, spotting areas where we can expand and we can say, okay, there's a gap here. What can I do to try and fill that? And how can I support that and increase it and make it a better patient's experience? But also in a way, looking at everything as an opportunity to go into the one file, really. I found this year, I pretty much just said yes to everything. And there's just a need to kind of say, well, if you say yes, it's going to be hard work, but it's also evidence to go forward. And that's quite exciting. One file still terrifies me. The prospect of having to fill it up and start populating with lots of different bits and pieces. I totally, totally get every single STP student now when they have their fear of, you know, the fear of one file. I'm totally on board with that. But at the same time, because it's bespoke, using that word again, it's very liberating to be able to sort of have that freedom. And it's quite exciting. It's really exciting, particularly when you see people approaching you now and saying, can you think about this? Or there's this problem. How do you think we would be able to challenge this or tackle this problem? And that's great, really. That's exactly where we want to be, to then feed back down to the other people in the department and say, this is going to be great and it's going to give you a pathway to move forwards.
It's true scientific leadership, isn't it? Which is what we've all hoped for, that this programme would bring. Alison, best bits for you, highlights so far. I know you're only a little way through, both of you, but...
I would say pretty much the same as James. For me, it's the opportunity, because I don't have a patient-facing role, the opportunity to actually get out there and see what decisions I make actually affecting the patient, and to then bring that back into the lab for my colleagues. I think we're removed, you know, they're just set of numbers or for us, and you know, you add tests or you don't add tests or whatever, and it's that bridge. So I'm looking forward to getting out there a bit more, meeting patients, and being that bridge and learning more about it, instead of it just being a set of numbers, which I think is easy to do.
And certainly some other people in lab sciences have also said it's really hard to think of how you can improve the service that you offer unless you know the full extent of the patient journey. You know, if you're only focused on one element, that's really tricky. So to be a true leader in your field, you to grasp that knowledge. So I can understand that that's really exciting. So are your expectations at the start, are they matched by the reality of what you're doing at the moment, James?
Honestly, probably not. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's been a while since I was at university. So I guess the concept of becoming a student again, you kind of feel like you're going to be sat in lecture halls and lots of things are going to be delivered. Actually, you know, there was none of that for the B modules. You know, some of that obviously got cut short, and the A modules are delivered in a slightly different way. So I think, from a student perspective, my expectations of being at the university were slightly different. The workload was as I expected. That's not been a huge shock yet, but that's simply down to the fact that so many people at so many levels, when you start applying for this, will say, you need to prepare yourself for this. You need to be able to manage your time. You need to be able to do this because there is a lot to take on. It's not been exactly as I anticipated. I was also expecting to be in Manchester a lot more. I think, you know, at some points we were kind of going, I expect to be in Manchester 1 week every single month, you know, and that was worst case scenario. And in fact, it transpired. We were there, three times, maybe something like that. So that was a bonus. But then obviously learning to learn online as a student rather than being a lecturer and delivering it as I'm used to doing was another challenge, really.
Okay, so it sounds like although the two aren't matched, it hasn't been a negative, which is a good thing. It's worked for you the way that it's worked out. Alison, for you, the expectations and reality, are they matched?
No, I would agree with James, not for me either. I think the workload, workload's definitely my expectations for the A modules. Yes, I would say so. But I think for me, I've not yet had the opportunity to do things that I would have liked to do. Now, that's probably COVID related, to be fair. I would have expected to have got further along by this stage, and I haven't. But you know, that's something to look forward to, things to do in the next year or so. And I think like James said, being back and being a student again, that was scary to start off with. I think I've only used my student card twice so far, so I've been very good. But getting one of those back again was great. And yeah, expected to spend more time in Manchester. Obviously, I have been twice and that's it so far. The plans I had for attending conferences, etc., they've all been curtailed. But that's the same for everybody, you know. And that's something to look forward to in the next 4 years, is to start attending conferences, attend my clinics, all the rest of it. So.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the pandemic has brought fresh challenges that perhaps we wouldn't have thought of. And that does seem to have affected the sciences differently. Mm. You know, there are some sciences who've really scaled back routine work and people have had more time to study. And then there are others who've been absolutely flat out who haven't had a moment to breathe. So there's bound to be some variation, I guess. And I'm sure you'll get lots of support now to pick up in the next year. Let's hope we don't see another big wave. What advice would you give to somebody considering an application from your discipline, James?
So really take a good look at the support team around you and start having those conversations with people quite early on. You know, have you got the consultant that's going to be there to support you? Because, you know, your relationship is going to be up and down. You're going to be nagging them at points and they're going to be nagging you, etc. So you need to make sure you've got that firm base, but also look around at the department and ask the questions really about the teams that you're working with. And are they happy to support you through this? Because you need buy-in from everyone, really. This isn't, although it's about us as an individual, the benefit is there for the team as well. And everyone supports you in their own way. And then be realistic with home life as well. You know, take a look at your home life situation and say, do I want to invest 5 years? You know, it's not a small chunk of time and it's going to take up a lot of hours on occasions. So just make sure that all the checks and balances are in place, really.
Alison, advice for haematology people thinking of applying?
Same as James, I would make sure you've got a good support team around you, consultants, lab staff, and think about how much time outside of work it's going to take. I would factor in that you're going to need at least an additional day a week, well, at least half a day, maybe a full day a week to be able to get all the objectives achieved. And some of it you're going to really dislike at times, like the A module sometimes, but you know, it's worth it. I hope it's going to be worth it in the end, and it's a fantastic opportunity, and you can't not, if you're in the right position to be able to do it, then you've got to go for it, I think.
Yeah, it does sound like, however hard it is, everyone I've spoken to has said it's worth it. Yeah. Everyone has said that it has changed the way they think about things. It's changing the way that they work. And that can only be a good thing, I think, moving forward. So that's pretty much it. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. I think it is really valuable because this sort of thing you just don't hear. You know, you've got all of the information that's available online, which is very driven by the national school, and it's useful, but it isn't the same as hearing from the horse's mouth what it's actually like. And for quite a lot of people, they're in departments where they don't know anyone who's doing this or who's done it. So what we're hoping is to reach those people particularly, and perhaps to try and encourage people to network with each other a little bit more. So if they, for example, if someone's in cardiology now and they've heard James talking about this, that they might think, well, if I need to pick somebody's brains, maybe James will answer my tweet, for example. So to get that sense of community a little bit more is really great. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Clinical Scientist podcast. We hope you found it informative and inspiring. If you've got any questions or you'd like to make some comments or send us some feedback, you can find us on Twitter @theclinsci or through our website, which is theclinsci.com.